Hello, this is Terry Malloy here to read the week, the best of U.S. and international media. This is the October 18th, 2019 volume, All You Need to Know About Everything That Matters. And on the cover, we have a bunch of the Supreme Court justices. How conservative will the new Supreme Court be? Power play, and it shows them on the football field with the sign in the back, conservatives 5, liberals 4. The main stories, a strategy of total defiance with Donald Trump. Talking points, how China dunked on the NBA. International news, is the press unfair to Harry and Meghan? And we will begin with our cover story, which is the controversy of the week. Supreme Court, how far will the conservative majority go? Watch out, America, said the New York Times in an editorial. The Supreme Court's new term began this week, and its newly emboldened conservative majority seems ready to flex its muscles. After last year's traumatic confirmation hearings for now Justice Brett Kavanaugh, the court finished its term fairly quietly, ducking several cases involving hot-button social issues. But the agenda for the new term reads like an index to our national culture wars. Starting this week with oral arguments on the question of whether employees can be fired for being gay or transgender. Also on the docket, gun control, the fate of the 700,000 Dreamers, and yet another bad faith Republican effort to overturn Obamacare, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate.com. What else could the court possibly take on to make this term more incendiary? Ah, yes, abortion. The justices will also review a Louisiana law that effectively regulates abortion clinics out of existence. The court struck down an almost identical Texas law in 2016, but that was before the arrival of conservatives Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. Liberals should brace for a jurisprudential bloodbath. Maybe not, said Amelia Thompson DeVoe in 538.com. Yes, conservatives finally have the solid 5-4 majority they've been working for since Roe v. Wade, and several justices, most notably Clarence Thomas, have made it clear they are willing, even eager, to overturn liberal precedents. But Chief Justice John Roberts has demonstrated a deep wariness of jeopardizing the court's status as a neutral arbiter and may resist a too obvious lurch to the right. Gorsuch might also be an unlikely swing vote, said Ian Milheiser in Vox.com. His belief in textualism, relying on the written text of law, may restrain his willingness to join his more active conservative colleagues. During oral arguments this week, Gorsuch sounded open to the idea that the 1964 Civil Rights Act banning sex discrimination should also protect gays on the grounds that what distinguishes gays is the sex of their lovers. Nonsense, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Congress didn't intend in 1964 to protect workers on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identification. If new laws are required as social mores change, then let Congress write them. Conservatives can count on Roberts in that case and many others, said Aaron Belkin and Sean McElwee in the New York Times. Despite his efforts to portray himself as a moderate, the Chief Justice has a voting record that's among the most partisan of any justice in the modern era. His subtle, long-game strategy is to let liberals notch occasional symbolic victories while he inexorably turns the Supreme Court into an extension of the Republican Party. Remember how we got here, said Jamil Bowie in the New York Times. Gorsuch is on the court because the GOP blocked President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland. Republicans rammed through Kavanaugh's nomination despite two credible accusations of sexual assault. Democrats should play constitutional hardball themselves by increasing the number of justices and packing the court. Let's fix the court instead, said David Edward Burke in WashingtonMonthly.com. Term-limiting justices to 10 years would help. So would raising the threshold for confirmation to 75% of Senate votes, which would screen our ideologues. The Supreme Court will remain politicized until both parties care more about protecting our institutions rather than controlling them. The White House, main story, the White House impeachment blockade. What happened? The White House drew battle lines for an unprecedented constitutional struggle this week, announcing it would refuse to cooperate with the House's impeachment inquiry on President Trump and would ignore subpoenas for testimony and official documents. In a defiant 8-page letter to House Democratic leaders, White House counsel Pat Cipollone denounced the impeachment proceedings as a constitutionally illegitimate attempt to undo the 2016 election. House Democrats have accused Trump of illegally using $400 million in military aid to pressure Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to pursue an investigation of his Democratic rival Joe Biden and his son Hunter, citing a transcript of a Trump-Zelensky phone call as proof. Cipollone dismissed such claims as baseless. But last week, Trump stood on the White House lawn and publicly called on both Ukraine and China to investigate the Bidens. The State Department blocked Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to European Union, from testifying before the House. Text messages obtained by Congress showed Sondland worked with other diplomats and the president's personal lawyers, Rudy Giuliani, to get Zelensky to commit to a statement announcing the investigation sought by Trump. Sondland suggested the statement was a precondition for an invitation to the White House, which Zelensky desperately wanted. I think POTUS Trump really wants the deliverable, Sondland wrote to the Ukraine envoy Kurt Volker. Texts show that diplomats were alarmed by the White House's arm twisting of Zelensky, which included a nearly 2-month delay in the delivery of military aid. I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign, the Ukrainian embassy's charged affairs William Taylor texted to Sondland in September. Sondland reportedly conferred with the White House and then denied that the president was seeking any quid pro quo before writing, quote, I suggest we stop the back and forth by text, unquote. House Democrats warned the Trump administration that stonewalling the investigation would be treated as evidence of obstruction of justice and would become part of an impeachment charge. Mr. President, you are not above the law, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said in a statement. You will be held accountable. What the editorials said. President Trump has taken his contempt for the rule of law to a new level, said the Los Angeles Times. Arguing the impeachment inquiry is illegitimate is laughable. Under the Constitution, the House sets its own rules and procedures for impeachment proceedings. There's no requirement that the House vote to authorize a formal inquiry, as the White House is demanding. Besides, Trump was directing aides to stonewall congressional investigations even before the impeachment inquiry began. If he has nothing to hide, why isn't he cooperating? Actually, precedent is on the White House side here, said the New York Post. The full House voted to open formal impeachment inquiries into Presidents Bill Clinton and Richard Nixon, setting clear rules that gave the president's defenders the right to call their own witnesses. But Speaker Pelosi is creating her own rules, questioning witnesses behind closed doors, and using selective leaks to damage the president as much as possible in the court of public opinion. The White House is entirely right to call out Pelosi's game. What the columnists said. Trump's every response to impeachment proves its necessity, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. Trump continues to brazenly commit impeachable acts in public, such as inviting foreign countries to interfere in our elections and then insisting he has the absolute right to do so. And the story can get worse. There were reportedly other calls between Trump and foreign leaders, such as Russian President Vladimir Putin and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, that so alarmed Trump's aides that the recordings were moved to a top-secret server. Unable to defend himself on the facts, Trump is hiding behind the nonsensical argument that investigating him is literally illegal. Trump isn't obstructing justice, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. Of course the White House is not going to start surrendering records just because Congress started issuing subpoenas. You can refuse to honor a subpoena if you can make a legal argument to avoid compliance. The Ukraine matter is in the realm of foreign relations, the place where presidents' constitutional power and privileges are at their most formidable. It's up to the courts to hash this out, which means we're in for a lengthy legal battle. The White House's actual legal argument is preposterous, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. The Cipollone letter, which sounds like it was written by a seventh grader, repeatedly whines that the House isn't being fair to Trump, so he's entitled to nullify a process spelled out in the Constitution. Trump's critics have long feared the day when his narcissism and authoritarian instincts would threaten the very nature of our democratic system. That constitutional crisis has arrived. What next? The deluge of damaging revelations appears to be sticking to Trump, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post. A new poll shows that 58% of Americans now support the impeachment inquiry, while 49% think Congress should remove him from office. Most alarming for Trump, his Republican support appears to be eroding. Roughly 28% of GOP voters now support the impeachment investigation, a 21-point increase since July, while 18% say he should be removed from office. The Republican Senate, resting on the bedrock of Donald Trump's base, has been viewed as an unbreachable wall, said Gabriel Sherman in VanityFair.com. But there are signs it's beginning to crack. Utah Senator Mitt Romney, who publicly called Trump's entreaties to Ukraine and China wrong and appalling, has reportedly been privately sounding out other moderate Republicans about voting to convict Trump in an impeachment trial in the Senate. Romney is the one guy who could bring along Susan Collins, Cory Gardner, Ben Sasse, a GOP advisor said. That's why the things he's saying are freaking Republicans out. The U.S. steps aside as Turkey attacks Kurdish allies. What happened? Turkey launched a military offensive against U.S. allied Kurdish forces in northern Syria this week after President Trump appeared to greenlight the operation, a decision that sparked rare bipartisan backlash in Washington. The Kurdish-dominated Syrian Democratic Forces, SDF, played a key role in the U.S.-led battle against ISIS, but is regarded by Turkey as an offshoot of the PKK, a guerrilla group that has fought for a Kurdish homeland in southeastern Turkey for decades. During a weekend phone call, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan told Trump that he intended to begin a long-delayed plan to roll back the SDF. Trump said a moderate incursion would be acceptable, U.S. officials told NBC News. Following the call, the White House ordered the withdrawal of roughly 100 U.S. troops stationed in the border area. Both Republicans and Democrats reacted with surprise and anger. Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, said Trump had shamelessly abandoned the Kurds and ensured the reemergence of ISIS. Trump pivoted in the face of criticism, warning Turkey that if it did anything that I and my great and unmatched wisdom considered to be off limits, he'd totally destroy the country's economy. Erdogan appeared not to take the threat seriously, and Turkish forces were soon pounding SDF targets. The Turkish leader said the operation was needed to prevent the creation of a terror corridor along his nation's southern border and to establish a safe zone that could accommodate millions of Syrian civil war refugees now living in Turkey. The SDF called the U.S. decision a stab in the back and vowed to defend our land at all costs. What the editorials said. Trump has made a serious mistake, said NationalReview.com. By the Pentagon's own reckoning, ISIS still had up to 18,000 fighters in the field as late as August. If Kurdish forces are fighting for their lives against a Turkish invasion, they can't mop up those jihadists. And what of the 11,000 suspected ISIS fighters being held in SDF detention camps? Trump says Turkey will take custody of the camps, but most are located far beyond the 20-mile-deep, 300-mile-wide strip of Erdogan hopes to seize. Most likely, the Kurdish guards will walk away to defend their homes and the jihadists will go free. The president claims he's fulfilling a promise to stop America's endless wars, said the Washington Post. And he's indicated that he might pull all 1,000 U.S. troops out of Syria. But unlike the massive missions in Afghanistan or Iraq, Syria has been a light-footprint, low-cost operation and a striking success. By backing SDF fighters with our air power and special operations troops, we've destroyed ISIS's would-be caliphate and prevented Iran from entrenching its forces along Israel's border with Syria. In 5 years, only 17 U.S. soldiers have been killed in action in Iraq and Syria combined. What the columnists said. Our betrayal of the Kurds is a gift to Russian President Vladimir Putin and Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad, said Nick Peyton Walsh and CNN.com. Abandoned by the U.S. and in need of military support, the SDF will have to strike a political deal with the genocidal Assad and his sponsor in Moscow. Assad's other backer, Tehran, will also benefit from a new alliance between the Kurds and Damascus, which will give Iran an almost clear run of friendly territory from its borders to Lebanon. Hezbollah's Israel-hating fanatics might soon find it a lot easier to get Iranian missiles shipped to their door. These are all the ugly results of an absurd Syrian policy, said Daniel Larrison in the AmericanConservative.com. For years, the U.S. has been fighting an illegal war in Syria that required our military forces to keep the peace between mutually hostile allies. Eventually, the U.S. was going to have to choose a side, fellow NATO member Turkey, or a proxy that has proven to be useful over the last few years. The Kurds never stood a chance. Letting our allies get annihilated is a fast way to ensure that we never have allies again, said Graham Wood in the Atlantic.com. The Kurds died in the desert by the thousands fighting ISIS, so that we Americans didn't have to revisit our bad dreams of the Iraq War. Now Trump has abandoned them on a whim to the mercies of the most powerful enemy. What a sickening betrayal, and one that will surely come back to haunt America. Our briefing this week, the obesity epidemic. Public health emergency is shortening our lives and supersizing out our health care costs. How serious is the crisis? Americans are collectively gaining weight at an alarming rate, with the average adult weighing about 15 pounds more than 20 years ago. In defining obesity, nutritionists focus on body mass index. A healthy person has a BMI of 18.5 to 24, while an obese person has a BMI above 30. Today, about 40% of U.S. adults and nearly 20% of children are obese, a surge reflected worldwide, with more people now overweight or obese, 1.9 billion, than underfed, 800 million. In 1985, no state in the U.S. had an obesity rate above 15%. Now, every state is higher than 20. Excess weight is a major factor driving runaway medical costs. Obesity-related diabetes alone will break the bank of our healthcare system, said University of Colorado nutrition expert James Hill. Obesity may be the toughest social issue that we have ever faced. What's making us fat? Simple. Eating too much and exercising too little. Despite constant debate over which dietary villain to blame, fats, carbs, sodium, sugar, obesity is primarily a problem of calorie intake. The average adult is eating about 300 more calories per day than in the 1970s. In 2015, for the first time, Americans spent more money eating away from home than they did on groceries, and research indicates people eat 20 to 40% more calories at restaurants, where portion sizes have quadrupled since the 1950s, according to the Center for Disease Control. American calories are also largely empty ones. Highly processed foods such as chips, white bread, and sugary cereals account for almost 60% of U.S. calorie consumption. These foods, plus artificial sweeteners, may disrupt nerve signals between the gut and the brain, causing us to keep eating long after we've had enough. As Yale University neuroscientist Dana Small explains it, it's as if the brain doesn't really know the food is even there. Who's most at risk? Children, and it's getting worse. Addressing childhood obesity is like playing whack-a-mole, said Harvard nutritionist Erica Kenny. Kids are spending more and more time indoors looking at screens, where they're bombarded with advertisements for unhealthy foods. Black children see twice as many soda and candy ads as white kids do, which is just one reason why childhood obesity is racially skewed. A 2017 study showed that about 26% of Hispanic youth and 22% of black youth were obese, compared with 14% for white youth and 11% for Asian youth. Children are gaining weight faster than adults, with the obesity rate for U.S. kids 5 to 9 projected to hit 26% by 2030. What's wrong with weight gain? Having a high BMI doesn't necessarily mean a person is unhealthy. Still, the correlations are strong. As obesity surged over the past three decades, U.S. diabetes rates tripled, and now more than 100 million adults have diabetes or pre-diabetes. Research suggests that obese people are between 1.5 and 2 times more likely to die of heart disease. Other illnesses linked to obesity include high blood pressure, arthritis, Alzheimer's disease, gallbladder disease, sleep apnea, sexual dysfunction, and at least 13 types of cancer. Excess body fat is associated with higher insulin levels, which may spur cell growth and, in turn, increase the probability of cancer. The American Cancer Society believes excess weight is linked to about 7% of cancer deaths, and obesity will soon overtake smoking as a top preventable cause of cancer. How does it affect healthcare costs? Obesity adds between $147 billion and $210 billion to annual U.S. healthcare expenses, increasing an average adult's medical cost by 42%, an estimated $200,000 over a lifetime. This burden hits low-income households hardest, creating a vicious cycle of poverty, leading to poor dietary habits, leading to costly weight-related illnesses. Expenses range from basics like insulin, which is used to treat diabetes and costs up to $900 a month, to the increased need for expensive interventions such as heart surgery. Medicaid now covers bariatric surgery because doctors believe a roughly $25,000 stomach shrinking procedure is cheaper than a lifetime of chronic disease treatment. What else can be done? Dieting is a $66 billion industry, but studies show the vast majority of dieters quickly gain back the weight they lose, and sometimes more. Broader lifestyle interventions are required. In Amsterdam, overweight kids are referred to a nurse who helps them and their families identify healthier habits. Between 2012 and 2015, Amsterdam's population of overweight youth dropped 12%. Japan, the least obese country, is even more paternalistic, requiring overweight adults to attend diet classes. Americans bristle at any government intervention in their eating habits, such as sin taxes on sugary beverages. Yet when Philadelphia imposed such a tax in 2017, it saw a 38% drop in sales. In the meantime, obesity is brutally pricey from the crib to the grave. A wider cemetery plot, reinforced hearse, and plus-size casket can add $3,000 to the cost of a funeral. The pain of fat shaming. The comedian Bill Mailer enraged many of his liberal fans last month when he said, "Fat shaming doesn't need to end, it needs to make a comeback." He argued that as Americans grow more and more obese, we're letting them off the hook in the name of politically correct. Well, that's it for this week. This is Terry Malloy wishing you all a great week ahead, and I will be back next Sunday to read the week.